Today is Monday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, protesters in Hong Kong stormed the Legislative Council building, painting slogans inside the chambers before police moved in. Reaction from Seoul, South Korea after U.S. President Donald Trump becomes the first sitting American leader to set foot in North Korea.
We met and we liked each other from day one, and that was very important.
And a powerful car bomb and gun attack in the Afghan capital of Kabul. Those stories and more are all ahead on today's International Edition. Hong Kong police moved in to clear hundreds of protesters who stormed the legislative building on the anniversary of the city's 1997 return to Chinese rule Monday, destroying pictures and defacing walls with graffiti in a direct challenge to China. The police arrived by bus and ran into position as about 1,000 gathered around the Legislative Council building in the heart of the former British colony's financial district. Protesters carried road signs, others corrugated iron sheets and pieces of scaffolding as they barged into the council building. Some sat at legislators' desks checking their phones while others scrawled anti-extradition on chamber walls. Other graffiti called for Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam to step down while pictures of some lawmakers were defaced. The protests were triggered by a controversial legislative bill that would allow for criminal extradition to China. The bill has ignited mass protests for most of the month of June, continuing after Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam said previously she would suspend the bill and apologize. Reporter Erin Hale is in Hong Kong, and I spoke with her earlier and asked her what the message the protesters were trying to send.
They're looking, I think, to let her know that they're still very angry. Last time in 2003, saw a protest of this size against national security legislation. The government did suspend the bill similarly as Carrie Lam has done, and everybody went home. But this time people are much angrier. They still want the bill to be withdrawn permanently. They say they do not trust her. Trust in the government is much lower now than it was in 2003. They also want an independent investigation into police brutality on protests on June 12th. And they say they would like for her to step down. Really, I think under this, though, there is an undercurrent that Hong Kongers are really afraid that they're either going to lose what rights they have left. And, you know, Hong Kong will just become like China, ahead of schedule, just cannot do that until 2047. This is also sort of unwittingly, I think, reignited. Some people say the democracy movement here. I think people really see that without a representative government, you know, these issues are going to just keep coming up where the government does not listen to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on the street. There's been protests all month, and, you know, they still have not done a single thing that people have asked.
What recourse of action do the residents of Hong Kong have?
Well, you have what they've called these protests, something like a negative version of democracy, where people, you know, are voting with their feet, where they're coming out and showing, you know, we will not back down. You've seen an escalation in tactics. There's a real sense, I think, that, you know, this is the last battle for Hong Kong. It's going to change. But you also have, you know, a lot of people, I think, trying to leave Hong Kong. There have been, I understand, you know, inquiries into, like, moving to places like Taiwan, Canada. A lot of people, if they can leave, they will leave because they don't like the direction that the city is heading in. There are, of course, the silent, you know, Hong Kongers who are happy for business as usual. That's probably the other half of the city. They just want to keep, you know, making money running their businesses, so they're okay. But for the political Hong Kongers, I think the situation is quite negative right now.
That was reporter Erin Hale in Hong Kong. The extradition legislation has drawn opposition from the legal profession, commercial groups, and foreign nations, reflecting Hong Kong's status as an international business center with a strong independent judiciary and high degree of transparency. There's been no comment from Beijing on today's protest. A group of five heavily armed men Monday carried out a powerful vehicle bomb and gun attack in the Afghan capital of Kabul, killing at least one person and wounding dozens of others. Officials said the ensuing clashes lasted about 9 hours before Afghan security forces killed all the assailants. Interior Ministry spokesman Nasrat Rahimi, said security forces were in the process of cleaning the area and detonating explosives of the assailants that had brought with them. He promised to release a factual casualty toll soon. The Taliban quickly claimed responsibility for plotting the suicide raid against what it said was the logistics and engineering center of the Afghan Defense Ministry. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani denounced the Taliban attack, saying his government was conducting peace efforts, but the Taliban once again showed their nefarious will for continuation of the war and killing of civilians. Ambulances rushed to the scene and ferried one dead and around 100 injured people to hospitals, including children. According to the Afghan Health Ministry, the Education Ministry announced in a statement that 52 students were among those injured. Here are other top stories from around the globe. Iran announced on Monday that it had exceeded the limit on its stockpile of low-enriched uranium it agreed to in the 2015 International Accord restraining its nuclear weapons development. India launched a nationwide water conservation campaign to address a serious water crisis that has gripped at least half the nation. Five Japanese whaling ships set off Monday to begin the first commercial whale hunt in more than 30 years. Japan stopped commercial whaling in 1988 after the International Whaling Commission imposed a moratorium on killing the giant mammals. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and with our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The type of fungus we know as mold can be found in all types of environments, indoors, outdoors, and even in outer space at the International Space Station. It's been reported that ISS astronauts spend hours of time each week cleaning the space station's walls to keep mold from becoming a serious health issue. Scientists have found that mold spores can tolerate extreme temperatures, ultraviolet light, chemicals, and dry conditions. Now, new research presented at the American Geophysical Union's ABSCICON 2019 conference suggests that mold spores may also be able to survive exposure to ionizing radiation, such as X and gamma rays, at 200 times the dose that would kill a human. The research suggests that fungal spores should be considered in designing planetary protection protocols to prevent the contamination of planets and moons from visiting spacecraft. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to visit North Korea when he stepped across the border at the demilitarized zone Sunday.
This is my honor. I didn't really expect it. We were in Japan for the G20. We came over and I said, hey, I'm over here. I want to call up Chairman Kim. And we got to meet, and stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made. A lot of friendships have been made, and this has been in particular a great friendship. So I just want to thank you. That was very quick notice, and I want to thank you.
The president called his latest meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un very productive and said both countries want to get this thing solved. Trump has repeatedly pointed to potential economic benefits North Korea could experience if it agrees to a deal on its nuclear program. Earlier, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo to get the latest reaction from Seoul.
Well, I mean, it's mixed, I can say. On one hand, you see a lot of people supporting these talks with Kim Jong-un. There's not a lot of room for some of the skepticism I think you see in the United States regarding, like, well, is this going to, like, confer legitimacy on him, on a dictator, things like that. That's not to say people aren't opposed to it. There's plenty of people who oppose President Moon Jae-in's outreach to North Korea. There's just an understanding here that things should not be as they were in 2017, whenever North Korea and the United States were exchanging threats of nuclear war and that Donald Trump was threatening to totally destroy North Korea. I think it is very welcome that both sides are talking rather than threatening each other at this point.
President Moon Jae-in's administration has really centered around engagement with North Korea. How has he responded publicly in the day after the meeting?
Well, President Moon has responded very positively. He needed this win very desperately. In the early days of his outreach to Kim, whenever he was having successes and they had their first meeting, his popularity rating here in South Korea was just through the roof. It was very high. Since talks have stalled, it's gone down pretty steadily. That's, you know, not to say he's quite unpopular. It's still higher than most South Korean presidents at this point in their term. However, things were looking quite bad for him until this. He needed this as a win just domestically here in South Korea.
Has there been much discussion, whether within lawmakers or business leaders in South Korea, as to what they are looking forward to next? Because the UN Security Council doesn't appear to be moving towards relieving sanctions. The United States at this point hasn't signaled that it's willing to reduce sanctions. But a lot of President Moon's economic plans revolve around inter-Korean cooperation that do run afoul of these international sanctions.
Well, South Korean business leaders, particularly those who did business at the Kaesong Industrial Complex in North Korea, are still pushing very hard to resume activities in North Korea, sort of in line with the activities you mentioned there. However, this is still prohibited from happening because of sanctions, and as you mentioned, there's no sign that the United States will back down on this at all. In fact, even though talks have, or they're said to be resuming soon, working level talks between the United States and North Korea, there is just no sign on either side that there is any more flexibility than there was, a few days ago. So where does this go from here? It's really hard to tell.
Has the Moon administration given any inclination as to when President Moon would next like to meet with Kim Jong-un? He invited Kim to Seoul during the September summit last year?
Not that I know of, but, you know, this is important to note that this meeting at the demilitarized zone with Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un did include Moon Jae-in, maybe not as much as some had hoped. They didn't make any real public statements or speeches together. Most of those events are between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. But this still was an event that Moon Jae-in was present for. They were seen together. They were photographed with each other. They were talking to each other. And while Moon Jae-in didn't take part in those bilateral, you know, extended talks between Trump and Kim, this was still very important for him to be seen together and to be seen as a mediator. What happens from here, it's really just not clear. I mean, there's been some talk, well, what's the only other thing that's sort of left on the list of summitry items that Donald Trump could possibly check off? One of those things would be a visit to the United States, perhaps, and he has extended that invitation to Kim, it appears. The other one could be some sort of summit in Pyongyang. Would President Moon come to that? We really don't know, and we don't really know if that would even happen at this point.
And that is VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. Following the meeting with Kim, Trump reiterated that he has developed a very positive relationship with Kim.
A lot of really positive things are happening, and I'm glad you could be here to see it, but tremendous positivity. Really great things are happening, and in a lot of places, but we met and we liked each other from day one, and that was very important.
But there was criticism in the United States following the president's meeting with Kim from Democratic presidential candidates. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Julian Castro says while he supports President Trump's meeting with Kim, he believes Trump is going about it the wrong way.
What's happened here is that this president has raised the profile of a dictator like Kim Jong-un and now three times visited with him unsuccessfully.
It was a sentiment also shared by Senator Bernie Sanders, a Democratic presidential candidate as well, who also appeared on ABC's This Week.
You don't have to say positive things about brutal dictators. You should sit down and negotiate with them. In the case of North Korea, if we can get rid of nuclear weapons there and their missile system, which is a threat to Europe and to the United States, that would be a very good thing.
Evans Revere, former U.S. State Department official dealing with East Asian and Pacific affairs, says he's unsure if the president's style of diplomacy will work.
It remains to be seen how this is going to turn out. I am a skeptic. Many years of dealing with the North Koreans and a pretty good sense of what their bottom line has been and continues to be makes me deeply skeptical that this process is going to end up with a success.
The United States and China agreed Saturday to restart trade talks after President Donald Trump offered concessions, including no new tariffs and an easing of restrictions on tech company Huawei in order to reduce tensions with Beijing. China agreed to make unspecified new purchases of U.S. farm products and return to the negotiation table, according to Mr. Trump. No deadline was set for the progress on the deal, and the world's two largest economies remain at odds over significant issues. The last major round of talks collapsed in May. Gary Hofbeyer is a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics, and I asked him earlier what this all means and where do we go from here.
Well, this is essentially a truce. It's not a peace settlement, and that's quite an important distinction. The details of the farm purchases remain to be revealed, how much, how soon, and so forth. And likewise, the details of Huawei's new permission to buy products from Silicon Valley remains to be determined. So there are a lot of details there. But in addition, the two leaders launched, or you could say relaunched, the trade talks between their respective ministries to deal with all the other issues which weren't settled. So, you know, it's certainly a better outcome than might have happened, which could have been a new round of tariffs on both sides. But it's not a big de-escalation of the existing tariffs which have been imposed by both countries.
What needs to happen on both sides to come to an agreement, to eliminate the trade dispute?
Well, that's a great question. President Xi made a statement, he made many statements, but he made a statement in the context of the Osaka G20 meeting listing several things that China is going to do on intellectual property, on forced technology transfer, on rights of foreign firms to do business in China, on lowering tariffs, and so forth. Now, if China actually carries out all the things that President Xi enunciated about six different topics, that could quite conceivably satisfy the United States. But U.S. Trade negotiators are skeptical. They say they've heard the music before. They're not sure it's going to be result in meaningful changes. And so they want to wait and see.
If it does continue to linger on, if the dispute continues for another 6 months, another year, what are global consumers likely to see in terms of how their daily lives may be affected?
If it just continues at this level without a further escalation of tariffs or other kinds of reprisals, consumers probably won't see much more than what they have already seen. What will happen is that many foreign companies doing business in China will probably decide to relocate to other countries. And so the effect will be felt in China. In terms of U.S. consumers, there will be markups on prices because the latest round of tariffs that Trump imposed on the $200 billion of U.S. imports are just, you know, beginning to feed into the system. And evidence indicates that these tariffs will be completely reflected in prices.
That was Gary Hofbeyer, non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
This just in. All of July, Border Crossings is having a very special CD giveaway. If you're looking to listen to the top songs of the summer, we've got the CD for you. Every weekday, we'll be giving away Now That's What I Call Hits and Remixes 2019.
Hooray!
The CD presents an 18-track lineup of this year's top singles and remixes to date. You'll have access to the hottest artists of the summer, including Taylor Swift.
Are you ready for it?
Marshmello and Selena Gomez.
I've been running through the jungle, I've been running with the wolves to get to you.
Shawn Mendes.
There's nothing holding me back.
Maroon 5.
Can you turn around? Can you turn around just wait?
And so many more. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time all of July to be able to listen to the top hits all summer long.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A Sudanese doctors group says at least five people were killed yesterday and several seriously wounded in a day of demonstrations against continued military rule in Sudan. The ruling military council says unidentified snipers fired on the crowds and says some of the dead were security forces. Thousands of protesters were on the streets again today, despite the violent Sunday, calling for a civilian government nearly 3 months after the army forced out the long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir. The protesters, some of them waving Sudanese flags, demanded the generals who took over power from al-Bashir make way for civilians. The European Union and several Western countries have also called on the generals to avoid bloodshed. Ethiopia and the African Union have offered a plan for a civilian majority body, which the generals say could be the basis for new negotiations. The International Labor Organization is launching a report dealing with the impact of heat stress stemming from climate change on labor productivity. It expects this could lead to global economic losses of $2.4 billion by 2030. Southern Asia and Western Africa are predicted to be the most affected in terms of job losses, and Lisa Schlein has more.
The ILO reports rising temperatures and increasing heat stress at work will lead to the loss of 80 million full-time jobs and to global economic losses of $2.4 trillion in 2030. Authors of the study call their estimates conservative as projections are based on a global temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Climate scientists predict temperatures could rise by as much as 3 degrees Celsius. The report says people who work outdoors, mainly in the agricultural and construction sectors, will be most affected by rising temperatures. It says agriculture will account for 60% of global working hours lost due to heat stress, followed by the construction sector with an estimated loss of 19%. The chief of the ILO's research department and a main author of the report, Catherine Sage, says Southern Asia and Western Africa are the most seriously affected regions. She says seven of the hardest hit areas are described as least developed countries in Africa.
Heat stress is concentrated in countries, in regions with existing decent work deficits, a large share of informal employment, extended working poverty, and limited social security coverage. In Africa, for example, 75% of the population has no legal health protection.
Sage says 2.3% of working hours will be lost in Africa in 2030 due to heat stress, which is higher than the global average of 2.2%. The report says workers in wealthy countries also will be affected by excessive heat, but to a much lesser extent than those in poor countries. This, it notes, will widen the inequality gap between low and high income countries and result in worsening working conditions for the most vulnerable. The ILO urges governments to enact policies to address heat stress risks and protect workers. These include the creation of better working conditions and improving early warning systems for heat events. It also calls for enhancing occupational safety and health to help people tackle heat-related hazards. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer John Dryden, thank you so much for joining us. Now, if you'd like some pictures, videos, news stories, and more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.